Hello and welcome to the Atlanta Opera Podcast, The Business of Opera. The series is inspired by the programming of the piece, The Revolution of Steve Jobs at the Atlanta Opera in the spring of 2022. In preparation for the premiere of the show in Austin, Kansas City, and in Atlanta, we will have a series of interviews with business leaders, opera impresarios, artists, and strategic thinkers, as well as creative minds who will focus on two themes. Number one, the business of opera and the role of leadership in this business. And number two, the very controversial and mysterious character of Steve Jobs and the opera written about him. My guest in this episode is the wonderful composer Mason Bates, a Grammy Award-winning American composer of symphonic music, and also a DJ of electronic dance music. Mason is the first composer in residence of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts and has also been in residence with Chicago Symphony Orchestra, the San Francisco Symphony, the Pittsburgh Symphony, and the California Symphony. The Revolution of Steve Jobs was his first opera and it won the Grammy Award back in 2017. At the Atlanta Opera, we are working fervently to create a new production of Steve Jobs. And in this discussion, we are talking a little bit about this process. In his music, Mason blends expressive electronics, including guitar, with rich opera orchestration. And I'm very excited to share with you our conversation. I want to hear how it all started. So I know that this was commissioned by Santa Fe Opera. Probably Charles McKay gave you a call one day and asked you to write an opera about Steve. How did it all start?
Well, it's a little bit longer story. I mean, I'll try to keep it short, but it's interesting. One of the big messages is be careful what you wish for. I was pitching operas to Santa Fe Opera for years. I would go there, I think as early as 2003. Brad Wolbright, who was the number two man there forever.
Yeah.
He saw several pieces of mine that I showed him, and I couldn't understand why he didn't want to do them. He was probably thinking, well, he's not ready yet. So time passes, and actually the piece began because UC Berkeley, Cal Performances, had been given some kind of a Mellon Foundation grant, and Matthias Tarnopofsky, who now runs the Philadelphia Orchestra, but he used to run Cal Performances, he sat with me in Rock Ridge and said, hey, what could you write about? And, I said to him, I'm so used to seeing all these creative technologists that we see out here in the Bay Area. And, you know, they are creative people. And yet there's been no opera written about them. We have creative people in opera all the time, you know, La Boheme or Tales of Hoffman or Death in Venice. And I said, I think there's an opera about Steve Jobs that could be written. And interestingly, one of the responses that I get a lot is that people find it very surprising. And I've just learned to appreciate that because it kind of intrigues people. For me, it seems like such an operatic subject matter. But a lot of people find it to be like, whoa, it's like, how could you write an opera about Steve Jobs? So Cal Performances saw that this thing was getting bigger and bigger. And eventually I went back to Santa Fe and said, you know, we've talked a lot over the years. Is this the one? And they, like, bless their hearts, were like, we want to do this. And the next group that came on was San Francisco Opera and Seattle Opera and Indiana University. They all joined together. So it took a long time to get to that point. And during the development process, I was kind of terrified that somebody else was going to write an opera about Steve Jobs because it seems just like such an ideal piece. And it never ceases to amaze me that people find it like so provocatively surprising. They're like, oh, wow, how are you going to do that? I got to hear that. And maybe John Adams told me, like, he had the same thing with Nixon in China where people were like, whoa, how could you write an opera about Nixon? And so there are things like that when you choose an opera subject. There could be some provocative elements of the subject matter before you hear a note.
How the hell do you do research as a composer on Steve Jobs?
You mean like for the music? How do you find the music of Steve Jobs?
Where do you start and how do you take a lifetime, right? 56 years, but he lived more than 56 years. And how do you choose what to focus on? Let me unpack that. So in your operas, in your opera, you have Steve, who is lit by those four characters, right? There's the wife, Lorene, there's the ex-girlfriend, Chrisanne, there's the spiritual advisor, Coben, and there's the business partner, Wozniak. You look at Walter Isaacson's book, he starts with the characters in the story. There's 50 of them. And you guys made decisions, which I'm sure were not easy, to take a 56-year story, 56-year life, 650 pages book, multiple characters in his life, and you chose to focus on specific people that illuminate the character of Steve Jobs. How do you get there?
It's a great question, and one that thankfully Mark and I were from the beginning kind of on the same page. We made a couple early decisions just walking around and talking that proved to be, I think, really important for the shape of it. One is that we wanted it to be a quick piece. We felt like the subject matter is, you know, technology, it's changing fast. We kind of wanted the actual like feeling of the piece to reflect the kind of quicksilver world of technology. What does that mean for like getting a little deeper into it? Well, we thought it'd be fascinating if we could do this in a kind of a nonlinear way. I think Mark and I both have felt that in any kind of biopic, whether it be an opera, movie, or even a book, you know, it can be a little bit boring if it just deliberately goes through the different stages of life and there's this, that, and the other. You miss the opportunity to draw juxtapositions and contrasts by putting a scene from 20 years ago right next to one that happened in almost the present day. That's what opera can do that you can't do as easily in other mediums. You know, even film, which we all know that film is not real, but because it's representational, you know, you kind of, very few films really are just like 21 different short scenes. There's, you know, I can think of the Glenn Gould film or something. So we made that decision that we wanted it to be kind of going backwards and forwards and to have a kind of emotional arc to it. It would absolutely have an emotional arc. A couple other key decisions were that if something didn't really seem to help the opera, we didn't put it in. I told him several times, and Mark, thankfully, you know, he stayed true to what we were, the subject matter, but I said to him, we want to make a great opera. We don't want to have anything in here that is because we have to put it in. You know, like, and there are elements of his life that are fascinating, whether it be Pixar or whatever, that just has no place in this opera. So, and a final key decision was his wife, both because of the actual fact that Lorene was the kind of electrical ground between the negative and positive forces of Steve's brain, and because it's always cool to have a strong woman in an opera. We wanted to have her kind of steal the show. It's really interesting when you're watching any, you know, opera, book, whatever, movie, and there's a character that kind of grows in importance and you realize, whoa, is it about that person or is it about the person I thought it was about? So, you know, Lorene grows in importance in the opera and then has these two huge arias at the very end. And we decided that that was going to be a key element to the piece, that the piece was going to get warmer as it became more clear that, you know, you have to treat people like humans and not robots. So there's a couple of just basic things, but that allowed us to cut so much away. Then you could say, well, there are all these fascinating stories of him, you know, driving over to Pixar and selling a stock to Disney or whatever. But, you know, even the story of his daughter, Mark pushed back against me. I mean, I was kind of like, that's opera right there. And he's like, it doesn't really go anywhere. You know, like we can explore it for what it is, but it doesn't have a kind of denouement. And so he said, let's not make the whole piece about that. So when you make the decision early on that you want to have it kind of be nonlinear, we want to have it go to a warm place. We want to definitely focus on his wife. We want to kind of use these different characters to refract the light around him. It allowed us to cut And that was important. You know, it's important. I mean, Tomer, like to put anything on stage. I mean, I just saw Tosca for the millionth time at the Met. I mean, at the SF Opera. And I was just like reminded again, wow, there's so much that's not in that piece. I mean, it just goes straight through. And
there's no fat. Yeah. Which is why, you know, the choices that you guys made and the ending, and I want to talk a little bit about the ending, which you briefly mentioned. At the very end, spoiler alert, right, for those who don't know the opera, we're in Steve Jobs Memorial's service, and he's there watching the whole thing and even commenting on how he would do it differently. He would decorate it differently, of course. And it ends with this amazing kind of reflective moment when Lorraine says, kind of breaks the fourth wall and says, okay, so I know what happens at the end of it. All of you are going to take out your cell phones and would look at the device that Steve created. But she ends it with look up. Don't forget to look up. And so to me, that's it's an important moment and reminds us of the dangers that technology and the creation of Steve Jobs can introduce to us.
Yeah.
When you think about what you want the audience to walk away with, what is it? What is the most important thing for you, Mason?
Well, you know, you put the right emphasis on it. I mean, look up, look out is the kind of message, you know. The message is engage with the people around you. Look at what's around you. It's ultimately about being human. You know, you have a fancy opera with, you know, cool projections and about a technologist, and you've got arias about devices and motherboards and whatnot. That sounds very, you know, buzzword exciting of the moment, but it can't be only about that. I mean, and I think Jobs, it's definitely discussed a bit in the Isaacson book. It's not exactly known, but I think towards the end of his life, he really did start to ask himself, you know, what is this all about? And you know, is it always about just making a faster phone with a longer battery life? And so the look up, look out, it is Lorraine singing that, but, you know, many people in the opera could be singing that. I mean, a big part of the opera is Ko Boon, his Buddhist spiritual advisor, who's part of Jobs' life for a long time. Jobs really searched for this kind of inner peace. He never got there, but he searched. He really wanted it. He cultivated, you know, Buddhist philosophy. And so when you hear Lorraine saying, look up, look out, I think it's a good reminder for all of us that, you know, coming together is the key thing. And, you know, honestly, Tomer, like the past year and a half, all this Zoom stuff and, you know, don't go anywhere, don't talk to anybody, put a mask on, you know, for good reason. But I think it's going to make hearing those words at the end of the opera especially poignant. I mean, true human connection is irreplaceable. I don't care what, you know, Jack Dorsey says at Twitter, nobody needs to come to the office. You really do. I mean, we're all invested. We're wired to be together. So that's really the message is that, you know, look around, be human, care about
that. I love that. Now, let's talk a little bit about your music, which is to me is mind-blowing. And as I listen to it, what I love about it is that it captures the dichotomy of his character, right? Because on one hand, you have this barefoot hippie versus a sophisticated, wealthy yuppie, a Zen Buddhist, because that's what he really was deep down inside, versus this power-wielding CEO. Extreme minimalism, nothing in his home, right? Not even furniture. Couldn't decide on furniture. And extreme access. Artist. He was an artist versus a businessman. And you captured in your music those two worlds, right? This amazing world of Zen Buddhism, Asian influences, the character of Coben. And on the other hand, technology, digital, electronic, propulsive feeling. And in the middle, you have the walk in the mountains that connects those two, because I believe that he found inspiration for all of his innovations and inventions through meditation and Zen and walks in the mountains. And you also introduce a brilliant concept to me, and that is the contrast between the dynamic progression that gets into this climax in the presentation of the iPhone and then in the rise and fall of Steve Jobs. And you, the climax and the end of it is this sound of a computer shutting down, this idea of reboot. Tell us a little bit about your music, about what is important to listen to in your opera, Mason.
Yeah, well, it's so hard when you're first starting out. You know, you're going to find the sound of these characters. I think one thing I mentioned briefly earlier that's good to keep in mind is that I really wanted each character to have more than like a leitmotif, you know, which would be a theme that's associated with the character, like in Wagner. I really wanted them to have like a sound world, meaning, you know, a whole set of textures, maybe even into the realm of the electronic space. Because I really want kind of to dramatize this idea of communication and how people are merging together. So you take a character like Ko Boon. He has this almost just pure sound design, kind of like if you could have this, the music of just outer space is just kind of like processed kind of wind sounds and bamboo chimes and things, prayer bowls. That's so different from, let's say, the music that we first hear of Steve. Steve has this kind of hyperactive electronica undercurrent, which is both symphonic and electronic, and it also has elements of acoustic guitar. You know, I remember several times Jobs would put the image of an acoustic guitar on the iTunes store or something. He always loved the guitar, his favorite instrument. I thought it'd be a great instrument to use to conjure Steve's busy inner life. A guitar can, like, you know, through finger picking, can really like animate chords in a cool way. And so, so when you have somebody like Steve walk in the room, and then you have his wife, Laureen, you'll hear, you know, this kind of busy, you know, finger-picking guitar, electronica, Quicksilver when he's speaking. And then when she speaks, it's much more soulful, low strings, kind of harmonic. I call it almost like oceanic because she's grounded. So I guess the short answer is you hear a lot of different kinds of music. The key is to really define those spaces, those characters in the way that is true to who they are. And then the real magic happens when they start integrating. You know, it's towards the end of the opera, the music of Laureen kind of wins. You know, there are almost no electronics by the end of the piece. It becomes much more soulful and simple and direct. So I went and first kind of started to create their sound worlds by looking at the big numbers. And that's the key thing. You know, it's a number opera. I remember telling Mark, I would love to have numbers, arias that have a title that the title actually sounds like the aria, you know, encapsulates it, whether it be something we play or one device, look up, look out, take one step. And so, you know, the first thing I would do is, yeah, like find those big moments and try to set those. So it's really not like there are operas where, you know, there's just like a sound of the opera and the characters are kind of in it. I kind of wanted it to be like they each are their own kind of weather, and they kind of bring their music with them and they kind of collide and mix. And it's sort of basically a kind of hyper leitmotif approach.
You know, the other aspect of being a composer, which is not unlike Steve Jobs' character, is the idea of collaboration. And although one would want to have all the control in the world to make sure the vision is out there as you thought about it, opera is not a single person in a room coming up with his ideas. Because at the end of it, we have so many collaborators, from the singers that sing it to the librettist, the designers, the director, et cetera, et cetera. How do you feel about all of us coming together and taking your ideas that you came up with and eventually coming up with something that is not necessarily what you had in mind? How do you let go? Can you let go?
Well, you have to be able to. And I found that working in with orchestras in the symphonic world was a good preparation, although that's like the weather on Earth. And then the weather with opera is like Jupiter. It's so complicated with so many people. But, you know, an example would be, a simple example would be like a tempo indication or a piece of dynamic information in a score. It might be obvious that the players with the orchestra are naturally trying to do it a certain different way. Like maybe instead of it getting louder as it gets faster, they're kind of actually bringing it quieter because they feel like it's heightening the energy. I will always, if it's working, be like, that's it. Let's change what's in the score. That's the thing. The end of my piece, Mothership, was conducted by Manfred Onuk in Pittsburgh. And that piece has been done so many times. When he conducted it, he had this like impromptu accelerando at the end, which was really welcome because the piece has been kind of locked to this beat, exploded at the end like you whipped a horse or something. I put that in the score. I think that's awesome. So when you get to opera, you have to deal with that like on steroids. And you have to just understand that there are, you know, there's something beautiful in compromising. With Mark, for example, like we had a fair amount of productive friction, you know, where I would be looking for one thing and he would have his reasons for not wanting to do it that way. And often we would meet in the middle, and the middle was a better place than either of us. I remember, like, just on a more basic level, Santa Fe, this costume designer wanted to have Steve in like a turtleneck and jeans the whole opera. And I really told myself, like, don't get involved in stuff that you don't know enough about. You know, don't do that. I felt like that was an important thing. And I ended up being wrong, I think. But I really fought this because I was like, there are two problems with that. One, he didn't wear jeans and a turtleneck the entire time. Like when he was a hippie, he wasn't wearing that.
Right.
And the other thing is that it sort of gives us a cardboard cutout of Steve. So I was like, it's kind of two problems. And the costume designer, you know, like they ended up showing me, well, yeah, but also this opera is a kind of meditation, almost like from beyond the grave. You can interpret it. And I ended up realizing that, you know, I was just wrong. So it's good to see that sometimes. And, you know, you have to know what you don't know. I think it's worth saying that's something that I'm having a tough time with. But I generally don't do that unless it's something that really feels like it's missing the point, you know. So I try to really be a good collaborator because it only helps the piece. I mean, composers are renowned for being inflexible. I try not to be that way.
This podcast is called The Business of Opera, inspired by us doing Steve Jobs. And when I think about Steve Jobs and Apple, the mantras are so simple, right? It's simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, is idea number one. And number two is the campaign of Think Differently, 1997, Think Differently. Can we apply this to classical music and opera? Is there a way that we can be real and truly innovative in this medium that is 400 years old?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, this is the coolest medium. I mean, opera is, it fascinates people from all walks of life because it's like this noble medium that has undergone more evolution than like almost any other media. I mean, you think of it's gone from basically lutes and people kind of half singing to Wagner, and to now we're in, you know, Steve Jobs. I think opera can really absorb anything. And that's why I love the medium as, you know, it's always been connected to technology. We know that in the field. People might not think that in the mainstream, they might not realize it, but, you know, innovations in stagecraft and set design and instrument building, you know, were key in having this medium evolve. And I think the more and more that our lives are based around digital experiences, screens, we really need something to give us a kind of transformative, very deep, kind of cathartic experience. And I think the theater, where you're gathered with a lot of people and you're watching something that has the most unbelievable amount of collaboration happening, I mean, that is the answer. And there really will be no way for us as humans to explore some of these themes without having opera. You know, like I mentioned movies, you know, we love movies. Movies can be anything. I mean, they can be totally abstract. Generally speaking, they are more representational and kind of chronological. People aren't singing, you know, like in opera, you're automatically dealing with this kind of poeticized version of humanity. So I think it can absorb all themes. It's certainly changed dramatically over the years. And, you know, with great directors like you, you know, you're always looking for new work that can tell the story. To me, probably a little bit of the under the hood thing is like, you know, what are the basic things that you need as a human when you're in the theater? And so sometimes you look back through the history of opera. It's not all about, you know, like in Einstein on the Beach, you know, chanting numbers and doing loops. You know, sometimes you actually need like have somebody sing an aria about I love you or something, you know. And so I think the mix of new and old is always going to be a part of opera. It always has been.
Amazing. I mentioned that this was the last question, but I cannot help myself. Who's your role model from a composition standpoint? You mentioned John Adams. Are there any other people that influenced you that you aspire to be?
Sure. In just big strokes, you know, there are people from throughout music history whose music I love and I look up to. And some of them are kind of surprising. I mean, on the one hand, unsurprising might be somebody like Berlioz. He used just absolutely stunning innovations in orchestration to tell these narrative stories in the symphony hall. I mean, like telling stories about Hector, you know, in Italy, or Symphonie Fantastique, using these kind of innovations in orchestration. I mean, I absolutely look to Berlioz when I'm using digital sounds to tell new stories. But then there are also people that might not seem logical, but like Gershwin, you know, George Gershwin, you know, he brought two different kinds of music together and upgraded both with a real sophistication. And he did so in a way that was authentic. And, you know, I look at that when I'm thinking about integrating different kinds of music in my world. Of course, I look to my, you know, my mentor at Juilliard, John Corigliano. He just had an opera premiere at Santa Fe.
Right.
He's a master of using all kinds of different musical languages to tell a story that really works. You know, I absolutely look up to him. It's kind of funny. I mean, they're wonderful composers that are living now that I love, my contemporaries. There are very few people that really have a catalog that's really being actively played. And there are certain things that I can't talk to very many people about. You know, I can talk to John or Jennifer Higdon or a couple of people like about, hey, when a piece is in its second decade and it's still being, do you still reorchestrate? You know, and so sometimes in our world, if you are kind of trying to blaze your own path, there might not be that many precedents to look at, but there are always wonderful people that you can admire. And those are a couple of them. And I will also say that just in terms of pure music, there are people like Anna Klein, who I worked with the Chicago Symphony, who just a master at integrating electronic sounds into chamber music. And it kind of comes out of like psychedelic English music is what I think in her case. There are definitely people. I just ran into this composer named Quinn Mason. We're not related. He's a phenomenal composer. So you have to keep listening. I don't know. I don't know about you, Tomer, but the past year was weird. I mean, we all listen to recorded music, but I listen to it differently. If I'm in my studio right here, I'm kind of more like trying to find answers. Whereas if I'm in a concert hall, I hear much more like more healthy listening. And I've been trying to go out and hear more music because it's been a long year.
It has been a long year. And one of the things I love about Steve Jobs is his love to music and how much he loved Bob Dylan, which is one of my personal heroes too. So, hey, it's been an amazing hour. I feel like I could talk to you for days, and maybe I will when we're doing all those shows together.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. This is cool. I'm so thankful for you putting this whole thing together, and the number of people that have jumped on board is just shows that, you know, you've got a huge fan club of people that really trust you. And I think this is it's going to be a really cool thing to see it lift off.
I can't wait.